I'd led the boys to the first. We were all lined up outside getting ready to breach in when our OIC raised his voice. "Something doesn't look right," he said. "I'm not feeling this." I craned my head back and glanced around. "Shit," I admitted. "I took you all to the wrong house." We backed out and went to the right one. Did I ever hear the end of that? Rhetorical question. Twofer. One day we were out on an op near Sunset and another street, which came off on a T-intersection. Dauber and I were up on a roof, watching to see what the locals were up to. Dauber had just gone off the gun for a break. As I pulled up my scope, I spotted two guys coming down the street toward me on a moped. The guy on the back had a backpack. As I was watching, he dropped the backpack into a pothole. He wasn't dropping the mail. He was setting an IED. "Y'all gotta watch this," I told Dauber, who picked up his binoculars. I let him go about 150 yards away before I fired my 300 Win Mag. Dauber, watching through the binos, said it was like a scene from Dumb and Dumber. The bullet went through the first guy and into the second. The moped wobbled, then veered into a wall. Two guys with one shot. The taxpayer got a good bang for his buck on that one. The shot ended up being controversial. Because of the IED, the Army sent some people over to the scene, but it took them something like 6 hours to get there. Traffic backed up, and it was impossible for me or anyone else to watch the pothole for the entire time. Further complicating things, the Marines took down a dump truck suspected of being a mobile IED on the same road. Traffic backed up all over the place, and naturally the IED disappeared. Ordinarily, that wouldn't have been a problem, but a few days earlier, we had noticed a pattern. Mopeds would ride past a cop a few minutes before and after an attack, obviously scouting the place and then getting intel on the attack. We requested to be cleared hot to shoot anyone on a moped. The request was denied. The lawyers or someone in the chain of command probably thought I was blowing them off when they heard about my double shot. The JAG, Judge Advocate General, kind of like a military version of a prosecuting attorney, came out and investigated. Fortunately, there were plenty of witnesses to what had happened, but I still had to answer all the JAG's questions. Meanwhile, the insurgents kept using mopeds and gathering intelligence. We watched them closely and destroyed every parked moped we came across in houses and yards, but that was the most we could do. Maybe legal expected us to wave and smile for the cameras. It would have been tough to go in and just blatantly shoot people in Iraq. For one thing, there were always plenty of witnesses around. For another, every time I killed someone in Ramadi, I had to write a shooter statement on it. No joke. This was a report, separate from after-action reports, related only to the shots I took and kills I recorded. The information had to be very specific. I had a little notebook with me, and I'd record the day, the time, details about the person, what he was doing, the round I used, how many shots I took, how far away the target was, and who witnessed the shot. All that went into the report, along with any other special circumstances. The headshed claimed it was to protect me in case there was ever an investigation for an unjustified kill, but what I think I was really doing was covering the butts of people much further up the chain of command. We kept a running tally of how many insurgents we shot, even during the worst firefights. One of our officers was always tasked with getting his own details on the shooting. He, in turn, would relay it back by radio. There were plenty of times while I was still engaging insurgents and giving details to LT or another officer at the same time. It got to be such a pain in the ass that one time when the officer came to ask the details on my shot, I told him it was a kid waving at me. It was just a sick joke I made. It was my way of saying, fuck off. The red tape of war. I'm not sure how widespread the shooter statements were. For me, the process began during my second deployment when I was working on Haifa Street. In that case, someone else filled them out for me. I'm pretty sure it was all CYA, cover your ass, or in this case, cover the top guy's ass. We were slaughtering the enemy. In Ramadi, with our kill total becoming astronomical, The statements became mandatory and elaborate. I'd guess that the CO or someone on his staff saw the numbers and said that the lawyers might question what was going on, so let's protect ourselves. Great way to fight a war. Be prepared to defend yourself for winning. What a pain in the ass. I joked that it wasn't worth shooting someone. On the other hand, that's the only way I know exactly how many people I officially killed. Clear conscience. Sometimes it seems like God was holding them back until I got the gun. Hey, wake up. I opened my eyes and looked up from my spot on the floor. Let's rotate, said Jay, my LPO. He'd been on the gun for about 4 hours while I'd been catching a nap. All right. I unfolded myself from the ground and moved over to the gun. So, what's been going on? I asked. Whenever someone came on the gun, the person he was relieving would brief him quickly, describing who'd been in the neighborhood, etc. Nothing, said Jay. I haven't seen anyone. Nothing? Nothing. We swapped positions. Jay pulled his ball cap down to catch some sleep. I put my eye near the sight, scanning. Not 10 seconds later, an insurgent walked fat into the crosshairs, AK out. I watched him move tactically toward an American position for a few seconds, confirming that he was within the ROEs. Then I shot him. I fucking hate you, grumbled Jay from the floor nearby. He didn't bother moving his ball cap, let alone get up. I never had any doubts about the people I shot. My guys would tease me. Yeah, I know, Chris. He's got a little gun cut on the end of his scope. Everybody he sees is in the ROEs. But the truth was, my targets were always obvious, and I, of course, had plenty of witnesses every time I shot. The way things worked, you couldn't chance making a mistake. You'd be crucified if you didn't strictly obey the ROEs. Back in Fallujah, there was an incident involving Marines clearing a house. A unit had gone into a house, stepping over some bodies as they moved to clear the rooms. Unfortunately, one of the bastards on the ground wasn't dead. After the Marines were in the house, he rolled over and pulled the pin on a grenade. It exploded, killing or wounding some of the Marines. From then on, the Marines started putting a round in anybody they saw as they entered a house. At some point, a newsman with a camera recorded this. The video became public, and the Marines got in trouble. Charges were either dropped or never actually filed, since the initial investigation explained the circumstances. Still, even the potential for charges was something you were always aware of. The worst thing that you could ever do for that war was having all these media people embedded in the units. Most Americans can't take the reality of war, and the reports they sent back didn't help us at all. The leadership wanted to have the backing of the public for the war, but really, who cares? The way I figure it, if you send us to do a job, let us do it. That's why you have admirals and generals. Let them supervise us, not some fat-ass congressman sitting in a leather chair smoking a cigar back in D.C. in an air-conditioned office telling me when and where I can and cannot shoot someone. How would they know? They've never even been in a combat situation. And once you decide to send us, let me do my job. War is war. Tell me, do you want us to conquer our enemy, annihilate them, or are we headed over to serve them tea and cookies? Tell the military the end result you want, and you'll get it. But don't try and tell us how to do it. All those rules about when and under what circumstances an enemy combatant could be killed just didn't make our jobs harder. They put our lives in danger. The ROEs got so convoluted and fucked up because politicians were interfering in the process. The rules are drawn up by lawyers who are trying to protect the admirals and generals from the politicians. They're not written by people who are worried about the guys on the ground getting shot. For some reason, a lot of people back home, not all people, didn't accept that we were at war. They didn't accept that war means death, violent death most times. A lot of people, not just politicians, wanted to impose ridiculous fantasies on us, hold us to some standard of behavior that no human being could maintain. I'm not saying war crimes should be committed. I am saying that warriors need to be let loose to fight war without their hands tied behind their backs. According to the ROEs I followed in Iraq, if someone came into my house, shot my wife, my kids, and then threw his gun down, I was supposed to not shoot him. I was supposed to take him gently into custody. Would you? You can argue that my success proves the ROEs worked, but I feel that I could have been more effective, probably protected more people, and helped bring the war to a quicker conclusion without him. It seemed the only news stories we read were about atrocities or how impossible it was going to be to pacify Ramadi. Guess what? We killed all those bad guys. And what happened? The Iraqi tribal leaders finally realized we meant business, and they finally banded together not just to govern themselves, but to kick the insurgents out. It took force, it took violence of action, to create a situation where there could be peace. Leukemia. Her daughter is sick. Her white blood cell count is very low. I held the phone a little tighter as Taya continued to talk. My little girl had been sick with infections and jaundice for a while. Her liver didn't seem to be able to keep up with the disease. Now the doctors were asking for more tests, and things looked real bad. They weren't saying it was cancer or leukemia, but they weren't saying it wasn't. They were going to test her to confirm their worst fears. Taya tried to sound positive and downplay the problems. I could tell just from the tone of her voice that things were more serious than she would admit, until finally I got the entire truth from her. I am not entirely sure what all she said, but what I heard was leukemia, cancer. My little girl was going to die. A cloud of helplessness descended over me. I was thousands of miles away from her, and there was nothing I could do to help. Even if I'd been there, I couldn't cure her. My wife sounded so sad and alone on the phone. The stress of the deployment had started to get to me well before that phone call in September 2006. The loss of Mark and Ryan's extreme injuries had taken a toll. My blood pressure had shot up, and I couldn't sleep. Hearing the news about my daughter pushed me to my breaking point. I wasn't much good for anyone. Fortunately, we were already winding down our deployment, and as soon as I mentioned my little girl's condition to my command, they started making travel arrangements to get me home. Our doctor put through the paperwork for a Red Cross letter. That's a statement that indicates a service member's family needs him for an emergency back home. Once that letter arrived, my commanders made it happen. I almost didn't get out. Ramadi was such a hot zone that there weren't a whole lot of opportunities for flights. There were no helos in or out. Even the convoys were still getting hit by insurgent attacks. Worried about me and knowing I couldn't afford to wait too long, my boys loaded up the Humvees. They set me in the middle and drove me out of the city to TQ Airfield. When we got there, I nearly choked up handing over my body armor and my M4. My guys were going back to war, and I was flying home. That sucked. It felt like I was letting them down, shirking my duty. It was a conflict, family and country, family and brothers in arms, that I never really resolved. I'd had even more kills in Ramadi than in Fallujah. Not only did I finish with more kills than anyone else on that deployment, but my overall total made me the most prolific American sniper of all time, to use the fancy official language. And yet, I still felt like a quitter, a guy who didn't do enough. 12. Hard times. Home. I caught a military charter, first to Kuwait, then to the States. I was in civilian clothes, and with my longer hair and beard, I got hassled a bit, since no one could figure out why someone on active duty was authorized to travel in civilian clothes, which, looking back, is kind of amusing. I got off the plane in Atlanta and had to go back through security to continue on. It had taken me a few days to make it this far, and when I took my boots off, I swear half a dozen people in line nearly keeled over. I'm not sure I've ever gotten through security quite as fast. Taya. He would never tell me how dangerous things were, but I got to the point where I felt like I could read him. And when he told me that his guys were taking him out in a convoy, just the way he told me about it made me fear not only for them, but for him. I asked a couple questions, and the careful responses told me how dangerous his extract was going to be. I felt very strongly that the more people I had praying for him, the better his chances, so I asked if I could tell his parents to pray for him. He said yes. Then I asked if I could tell them why, about the fact that he was coming home and the danger in the city, and he said no. So I didn't. I asked people for prayer, alluded to danger, and gave no further details other than to ask them to trust me. I knew it would be a tough pill to swallow for those few I was asking, but I felt strongly that people needed to pray, and at the same time that I had to adhere to my husband's desire about what was to be shared. I know it wasn't popular, but I felt the need for prayer overrode my need for popularity. When he got home, it seemed to me Chris was so stressed he was numb to everything. It was hard for him to pinpoint how he felt about anything. He was just wiped out and overwhelmed. I felt sad for everything he'd been through, and I felt terribly torn about needing him. I did need him, tremendously, but at the same time, I had to get along without him so much that I developed an attitude that I didn't need him, or at least that I shouldn't need him. I guess it may not make any sense to anyone else, but I felt this strange mixture of feelings all across the spectrum. I was so mad at him for leaving the kids and me on our own. I wanted him home, but I was mad, too. I was coming off months of anxiety for his safety and frustration that he chose to keep going back. I wanted to count on him, but I couldn't. His team could, and total strangers who happened to be in the military could, but the kids and I certainly could not. It wasn't his fault. He would have been in two places at once if he could have been, but he couldn't. But when he had to choose, he didn't choose us. All the while I loved him, and I tried to support him and show him love in every way possible. I felt 500 emotions, all at the same time. I guess I had an undercurrent of anger that whole deployment. We'd have conversations where we talked and he realized something was wrong. He'd ask what was bothering me and I'd deny it. And then finally he'd press and I would say, "I'm mad at you for going back, but I don't want to hate you and I don't want to be mad. I know you could be killed tomorrow. I don't want you to be distracted by this. I don't want to have this conversation." Now, finally, he was back, and all of my emotions just exploded inside me. Happiness and anger all mixed together. Getting better. The doctors performed all sorts of tests on my little girl. Some of them really pissed me off. I remember especially when they took blood, which they had to do a lot. They'd hold her upside down and prick her foot. A lot of times it wouldn't bleed, and they'd have to do it again and again. She'd be crying the whole time. These were long days, but eventually the doctors figured out that my daughter didn't have leukemia. While there was jaundice and some other complications, they were able to get control of the infections that had made her sick. She got better. One of the things that was incredibly frustrating was her reaction to me. She seemed to cry every time I held her. She wanted mommy. Taya said that she reacted that way to all men. Whenever she heard a male voice, she would cry. Whatever the reason, it hurt me badly. Here I had come all this way and truly loved her, and she rejected me. Things were better with my son, who remembered me and now was older and more ready to play. But once again, the normal troubles that parents have with their kids and with each other were compounded by the separation and stress we'd all just gone through. Little things could really be annoying. I expected my son to look me in the eye when I was scolding him. Taya was bothered by this because she felt he wasn't accustomed to me or my tone, and it was too much to ask a 2-year-old to look me in the eye in that situation, but my feeling was just the opposite. It was the right thing for him to do. He wasn't being corrected by a stranger. He was being disciplined by someone who loved him. There's a certain two-way road of respect there. You look me in the eye, I look you in the eye. We understand each other. Taya would say, "Wait a minute, you've been gone for how long, and now you want to come home and be part of this family and make the rules? No, sir, because you're leaving again in another month to go back on training." We were both right from our perspectives. The problem was trying to see the others and then live with it. I wasn't perfect. I was wrong on a few things. I had to learn how to be a dad. I had my idea of how parenting should be, but it wasn't based on any reality. Over time, my ideas changed. Somewhat. I still expect my kids to look me in the eye when I'm talking to them, and vice versa. And Taya agrees. Mike Mansoor. I'd been home for roughly 2 weeks when a SEAL friend of mine called and asked what was up. Nothing much, I told him. Well, who'd y'all lose? He asked. Huh? I don't know who it was, but I heard you lost another. Damn. I got off the phone and started calling everyone I knew. I finally got a hold of someone who knew the details, though he couldn't talk about them at the moment, because the family had not been informed. He said he'd call me back in a few hours. They were long hours. Finally, I found out Mike Mansoor, a member of our sister platoon, had been killed saving the lives of some of his fellow platoon members in Ramadi. The group had set up an overwatch in a house there. An insurgent got close enough to toss a grenade. Obviously, I wasn't there, but this is the description of what happened from the official summary of action. The grenade hit him in the chest and bounced onto the deck. Here the Navy term for floor. He immediately leapt to his feet and yelled grenade to alert his teammates of impending danger, but they could not evacuate the sniper hide site in time to escape harm. Without hesitation and showing no regard for his own life, he threw himself onto the grenade, smothering it to protect his teammates who were lying in close proximity. The grenade detonated as he came down on top of it, mortally wounding him. Petty Officer Mansoor's actions could not have been more selfless or clearly intentional. Of the three SEALs on that rooftop, he had the only avenue of escape away from the blast, and if he had so chosen, he could have easily escaped. Instead, Mansoor chose to protect his comrades by the sacrifice of his own life. By his courageous and selfless action, he saved the lives of his two fellow SEALs. He was later awarded the Medal of Honor. A lot of memories about Mikey came back as soon as I found out he'd died. I hadn't known him all that well because he was in the other platoon, but I was there for his hazing. I remember us holding him down so his head could be shaved. He didn't like that at all. I may still have some bruises. I drove a van to pick up some of the guys from the airport and helped arrange Mikey's wake. SEAL funerals are kind of like Irish wakes, except there's a lot more drinking. Which begs the question, how much beer do you need for a SEAL wake? That is classified information, but rest assured, it's more than a metric ass ton. I stood on the tarmac in dress blues as the plane came in. My arm went up in a stiff salute as the coffin came down the ramp. Then, with the other pallbearers, I carried it slowly to the waiting hearse. We attracted a bit of a crowd at the airport. People nearby who realized what was going on stopped and stared silently, paying their respects. It was touching. They were honoring a fellow countryman even though they didn't know him. I was moved at the sight, last honor for our fallen comrade, a silent recognition of the importance of his sacrifice. The only thing that says we're SEALs are the SEAL tridents we wear, the medal insignia that show we're members. If you don't have that on your chest, you're just another Navy puke. It's become a sign of respect to take it off and hammer it into the coffin of your fallen brother at the funeral. You're showing the guy that you'll never forget, that he remains part of you for the rest of your life. As the guys from Delta Platoon lined up to pound their tridents into Mikey's coffin, I backed off, head bowed. It happened that Mark Lee's tombstone was just a few yards from where Mansoor was going to be buried. I'd missed Mark's funeral because I'd still been overseas, and still hadn't had a chance to pay my respects. Now it suddenly seemed appropriate to put my trident on his tombstone. I walked over silently and laid it down, wishing my friend one last goodbye. One of the things that made that funeral bittersweet was the fact that Ryan was released from the hospital in time to attend it. It was great to see him, even though he was now permanently blind. Before passing out from blood loss after he'd been shot, Ryan had been able to see. But as his brain swelled with internal bleeding, bone or bullet fragments that were in his eye severed his optic nerves. There was no hope for restoring sight. When I saw him, I asked him why he insisted on walking out of the building under his own power. It struck me as a remarkably brave thing, characteristic of him. Ryan told me he knew that our procedures called for at least two guys to go down with him if he couldn't move on his own. He didn't want to take more guys out of the fight. I think he thought he could have gotten back on his own, and probably he would have if we'd let him. He might even have picked up a gun and tried to continue the fight. Ryan left the service because of his injury, but we remained close. They say friendships forged in war are strong ones. Ours would prove that truism. Fighting is a fact of life when you're a SEAL. I've been in a few good ones. In April 07, we were in Tennessee. We ended up across the state line in a city where there'd been a big UFC mixed martial arts fight earlier that evening. By coincidence, we happened into a bar where there were three fighters who were celebrating their first victories in the ring. We weren't looking for trouble. In fact, I was in a quiet corner with a buddy where there was hardly anyone else around. For some reason, three or four guys came over and bumped into my friend. Words were said. Whatever they were, the wannabe UFC fighters didn't like him, so they went after him. Naturally, I wasn't going to let him fight alone. I jumped in. Together, we beat the shit out of him. This time, I didn't follow Chief Primo's advice. In fact, I was still pounding one of the fighters when the bouncers came to break us up. The cops came in and arrested me. I was charged with assault. My friend had slipped out the back. No bad wishes on him. He was only following Primo's second rule of fighting. I got out on bail the next day. I had a lawyer come in and work out a plea bargain with the judge. The prosecutor agreed to drop the charges, but to make it all legal, I had to get up there in front of the judge. "Mr. Kyle," she said in the slow drawl of justice, "just because you're trained to kill doesn't mean you have to prove it in my city. Get out and don't come back." And so I did, and haven't. That little mishap got me in a bit of trouble at home. No matter where I was during training, I would always give Taya a call before I went to sleep. But having spent the night in the drunk tank, there was no call home. I mean, I only had one call, and she couldn't get me out, so I put it to good use. There might not have been a real problem, except that I was supposed to go home for one of the kids' birthday parties. Because of the court appearance, I had to extend my stay in town. "Where are you?" asked Taya when I finally got a hold of her. "I got arrested." "All right," she snapped. "Whatever." I can't say I blamed her for being mad. It wasn't the most responsible thing I'd ever done. Coming when it did, it was just one more irritant in a time filled with them. Our relationship was rapidly going downhill. Taya, I didn't fall in love with a frickin' Navy SEAL. I fell in love with Chris. Being a SEAL is cool and everything, but that's not what I loved about him. If I'd known what to expect, that would have been one thing, but you don't know what to expect. No one does. Not really. Not in real life. And not every SEAL does multiple back-to-back wartime deployments either. As time went on, his job became more and more important to him. He didn't need me for family. In a way, he had the guys. Little by little, I realized I wasn't the most important thing in his life. The words were there, but he didn't mean it. Fights and more fights. I am by no means a badass, or even an extremely skilled fighter, but several instances have presented themselves. I would rather get my ass beat than look like a pussy in front of my boys. I've had other run-ins with fighters. I like to think I've held my own. While I was serving with my very first platoon, the whole SEAL team went to Fort Irwin in San Bernardino out in the Mojave Desert. After our training sessions, we headed into town and found a bar there called the Library. Inside, a few off-duty police officers and firemen were having a party. A few of the women turned their attention to our guys. When that happened, the locals got all jealous and started a fight, which really showed some truly poor judgment, because there had to be close to 100 of us in that little bar. 100 SEALs is a force to be reckoned with, and we did the reckoning that day. Then we went outside and flipped over a couple of cars. Somewhere around there, the cops came. They arrested 25 of us. You probably heard of Captain's Mast. That's where the commanding officer listens to what you've done and hands out what is called a non-judicial punishment if he thinks it's warranted. The punishments are prescribed by military law and can be anything from a stern tisk-tisk, don't do that again, to an actual reduction in grade and even correctional custody, which pretty much means what you think it means. There are similar hearings with less critical consequences heard by officers below the CO. In our case, we had to go before the XO, executive officer, the officer just below the commander, and listen while he told us in extremely eloquent language how truly fucked up we were. In the process, he read off all the legal charges, all the destruction. I forget how many people got hurt and how much money's worth of damage we caused, but it took a while for him to catalog. He finished by telling us how ashamed he was. "All right," he said, lecture over. "Don't let it happen again. Get the hell out of here." We all left, duly chastised, his words ringing in our ears for a good 5 seconds or so. But the story doesn't end there. Another unit heard of our little adventure, and they decided that they should visit the bar and see if history would repeat itself. It did. They won that fight, but from what I understand, the conditions were a little more difficult. The outcome wasn't quite so lopsided. A little after that, yet another military group soon had to train in the same area. By now, there was a competition. The only problem was that the folks who lived there knew there would be a competition, and they prepared for it. They got their collective asses kicked. From then on, the entire town was placed off limits for SEALs. You might think it'd be tough to get into a drunken brawl in Kuwait, since there really aren't any bars where you can drink alcohol, but it just so happened that there was a restaurant where we liked to eat and where, not so coincidentally, it was easy to sneak in alcohol. We were there one night and started to get a little loud. Some of the locals objected. There was an argument, which led to a fight. 4 of us, including myself, were detained. The rest of my boys came over and asked the police to release us. "No way," said the police. "They're going to jail and stand trial." They emphasized their position. My boys emphasized theirs. Kuwaitis finally saw it their way and released us. I was arrested in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, though I think in that case the circumstances may speak well of me. I was sitting in the bar when a waitress passed with a pitcher of beer. A guy at a table nearby pushed his chair back and bumped into her, not knowing she was there. A little bit of beer spilled on him. He got up and slapped her. I went over and defended her honor the only way I know how. That got me arrested. Those granolas are tough when it comes to fighting with women. Those charges, like all the others, were dismissed. The Sheriff of Ramadi. The Ramadi Offensive would eventually be considered an important milestone and turning point in the war, one of the key events that helped Iraq emerge from utter chaos. Because of that, there was a good deal of attention on the fighters who were there, and some of that attention eventually came to focus on our team. As I hope I've made clear, I don't feel SEALs should be singled out publicly as a force. We don't need the publicity. We are silent professionals, every one of us. The quieter we are, the better we are able to do our job. Unfortunately, that's not the world we live in. If it were, I wouldn't have felt it necessary to write this book. Let me say for the record that I believe the credit in Ramadi and in all of Iraq should go to the Army and Marine warriors who fought there, as well as the SEALs. It should be fairly proportioned out. Yes, SEALs did a good job and gave their blood, but as we told the Army and Marine officers and enlisted men we fought beside, we're no better than those men when it comes to courage and worth. But being in the modern world, people were interested in knowing about SEALs. After we got back, command called us together for a briefing so we could tell a famous author and former SEAL what had happened in battle. The author was Dick Couch. The funny thing was, he started out not by listening, but by talking. Not even talking. Mr. Couch came and lectured us about how wrong-headed we were. I have a lot of respect for Mr. Couch's service during the Vietnam War, where he served with Navy underwater demolition and SEAL teams. I honor and respect him greatly for that. But a few of the things he said that day didn't sit all that well with me. He got up in front of the room and started telling us that we were doing things all wrong. He told us we should be winning their hearts and minds instead of killing them. SEALs should be more SF-like, he claimed, referring, I guess, to one of Special Forces' traditional missions of training indigenous people. Last time I checked, they think it's okay to shoot people who shoot at you, but maybe that's beside the point. I was sitting there getting furious. So was the entire team, though they all kept their mouths shut. He finally asked for comments. My hand shot up. I made a few disparaging remarks about what I thought we might do to the country. Then I got serious. They only started coming to the peace table after we killed enough of the savages out there, I told him. That was the key. I may have used some other colorful phrases as I discussed what was really going on out there. We had a bit of a back and forth before my headshed signaled that I had to leave the room. I was glad to comply. Afterward, my CO and command chief were furious with me, but they couldn't do too much because they knew I was right. Mr. Couch wanted to interview me later on. I was reluctant. Command wanted me to answer his questions. Even my chief sat me down and talked to me. So, I did. Yup. Nope. That was the interview. In fairness, from what I've heard, his book is not quite as negative as I understood his lecture to be. So, maybe a few of my fellow SEALs did have some influence on him. You know how Ramadi was won? We went in and killed all the bad people we could find. When we started, the decent, or potentially decent, Iraqis didn't fear the United States. They did fear the terrorists. The U.S. told them, "We'll make it better for you." The terrorists said, "We'll cut off your head." Who would you fear? Who would you listen to? When we went into Ramadi, we told the terrorists, "We'll cut your head off. We will do whatever we have to and eliminate you." Not only did we get the terrorists' attention, we got everyone's attention. We showed we were the force to be reckoned with. That's where the so-called Great Awakening came. It wasn't from kissing up to the Iraqis. It was from kicking butt. The tribal leaders saw that we were badasses, and they'd better get their act together, work together, and stop accommodating the insurgents. Force moved the battle. We killed the bad guys and brought the leaders to the peace table. That is how the world works. Knee surgery. I'd first hurt my knees in Fallujah when the wall fell on me. Cortisone shots helped for a while, but the pain kept coming back and getting worse. The docs told me I needed to have my legs operated on, but doing that would have meant I would have to take time off and miss the war. So I kept putting it off. I settled into a routine where I'd go to the doc, get a shot, go back to work. The time between shots became shorter and shorter. It got down to every 2 months, then every month. I made it through Ramadi, but just barely. My knees started locking, and it was difficult to get down the stairs. I no longer had a choice, so soon after I got home in 2007, I went under the knife. The surgeons cut my tendons to relieve pressure so my kneecaps would slide back over. They had to shave down my kneecaps because I had worn grooves in them. They injected synthetic cartilage material and shaved the meniscus. Somewhere along the way, they also repaired an ACL. I was like a racing car being repaired from the ground up. When they were done, they sent me to see Jason, a physical therapist who specializes in working with SEALs. He'd been a trainer for the Pittsburgh Pirates and then went over to work for the San Diego Chargers. After 9/11, he decided to devote himself to helping the country. He chose to do that by working with the military. He took a massive pay cut to help put us back together. I didn't know all that the first day we met. All I wanted to hear was how long it was going to take to rehab. He gave me a pensive look. "This surgery, civilians need a year to get back," he said finally. "Football players, they're out 8 months. SEALs, it's hard to say. You hate being out of action and will punish yourselves to get back." He finally predicted 6 months. I think we did it in 5, but I thought I would surely die along the way. Jason put me into a machine that would stretch my knee. Every day I had to see how much further I could adjust it. I would sweat up a storm as it bent my knee. I finally got it to 90 degrees. "That's outstanding," he told me. "Now get more." "More?" "More." He also had a machine that sent a shock to my muscle through electrodes. Depending on the muscle, I would have to stretch and point my toes up and down. It doesn't sound like much, but it is clearly a form of torture that should be outlawed by the Geneva Convention, even for use on SEALs. Naturally, Jason kept upping the voltage. But the worst of all was the simplest, the exercise. I had to do more, more, more. I remember calling Taya many times and telling her I was sure I was going to puke, if not die, before the day was out. She seemed sympathetic, but come to think of it in retrospect, she and Jason may have been in on it together. There was a stretch where Jason had me doing crazy amounts of ab exercises and other things to my core muscles. "Do you understand it's my knees that were operated on?" I asked him one day when I thought I'd reached my limit. He just laughed. He had a scientific explanation about how everything in the body depends on strong core muscles, but I think he just liked kicking my ass around the gym. I swear I heard a bullwhip crack over my head any time I started to slack. I always thought the best shape I was ever in was straight out of Bud's, but I was in far better shape after spending 5 months with him. Not only were my knees okay, the rest of me was in top condition. When I came back to my platoon, they all asked if I'd been taking steroids. Rough times. I'd pushed my body as far as I could before getting operations. Now the thing that was deteriorating was even more important than my knees, my marriage. This was the roughest of a bunch of rough spots. A lot of resentment had built up between us. Ironically, we didn't actually fight all that much, but there was always a lot of tension. Each of us would put in just enough effort to be able to say we were trying and imply that the other person was not. After years of being in war zones and separated from my wife, I think in a way I'd just forgotten what it means to be in love, the responsibilities that come with it, like truly listening and sharing. That forgetting made it easier for me to push her away. At the same time, an old girlfriend happened to get in contact with me. She called the home phone first, and Taya passed the message along to me, assuming I wasn't the type of guy she had to worry about straying. I laughed off the message at first, but curiosity got the best of me. Soon my old girlfriend and I were talking and texting regularly. Taya figured out that something was up. One night I came home, and she sat me down and laid everything out, very calmly, very rationally, or at least as rational as you could be in that kind of situation. "We have to be able to trust each other," she said at one point. "And in the direction we're going, that's not going to work. It just won't." We had a long, heartfelt talk about that. I think we both cried. I know I did. I loved my wife. I didn't want to be separated from her. I wasn't interested in getting divorced. I know it all sounds corny as shit. A fucking SEAL talking about love. I'd rather get choked out 100 times than do that in public, let alone here for the whole world to see. But it was real. If I'm going to be honest, I have to put it out there. We set up a few rules that we would live by, and we both agreed to go to counseling. Taya. things just got to the point where I felt as if I was looking down into a deep pit. It wasn't just arguments over the kids. We weren't relating to each other. I could tell his mind had strayed from our marriage, from us. I remember talking to a girlfriend who'd been through an awful lot. I just unloaded. She said to me, "Well, this is what you have to do. You have to lay it all on the line. You have to tell him that you love him and you want him to stay, but if he wants to go, he is free to do so." I took her advice. It was a hard, hard conversation. But I knew several things in my heart. First, I knew I loved Chris. And second, and this was very important to me, I knew that he was a good dad. I'd seen him with our son and with our daughter. He had a strong sense of discipline and respect, and at the same time, he had so much fun with the kids that by the time they were done playing, they all ached from laughing. Those two things really convinced me that I had to try to keep our marriage together. From my side, I hadn't been the perfect wife either. Yes, I loved him, truly, but I'd been a real bitch at times. I had pushed him away. So both of us had to want the marriage, and we both had to come together to make it work. I'd like to say that things instantly got better from that point on, but life really isn't like that. We did talk a lot more. I started to become more focused on the marriage, more focused on my responsibilities to my family. One issue that we didn't completely resolve had to do with my enlistment and how it would fit with our family's long-term plans. My earlier reenlistment was going to be up in roughly 2 years. We had already begun discussing that. Taya made it clear that our family needed a father. My son was growing in leaps and bounds. Boys do need a strong male figure in their lives. There was no way I could disagree. But I also felt as if I had a duty to my country. I had been trained to kill. I was very good at it. I felt I had to protect my fellow SEALs and my fellow Americans. And I liked doing it. A lot. But I went back and forth. It was a very difficult decision, incredibly difficult. In the end, I decided she was right. Others could do my job protecting the country, but no one could truly take my place with my family, and I had given my country a fair share. I told her I would not reenlist when the time came. I still wonder sometimes if I made the right decision. In my mind, as long as I am fit and there is a war, my country needs me. Why would I send someone in my place? A part of me felt I was acting like a coward. Serving in the teams is serving a greater good. As a civilian, I'd just be serving my own good. Being a SEAL wasn't just what I did. It became who I was. A fourth deployment. If things had worked according to normal procedures, I would have been given a long break and a long stretch of shore duty after my second deployment. But for various reasons, that didn't happen. The team promised that I'd have a break after this deployment, but that didn't work either. I wasn't real happy about it. I lost my temper talking about it, as a matter of fact. I guess more than once. Now, I like war, and I love doing my job, but it rankled me that the Navy wasn't keeping its word. With all the stress at home, an assignment that would have kept me near my family at that point would have been welcome. But I was told that the needs of the Navy came first. And, fair or not, that's the way it was. My blood pressure was still elevated. The doctors blamed it on coffee and dip. According to them, my blood pressure was as high as if I were drinking 10 cups of coffee right before the test. I was drinking coffee, but not nearly that much. They strongly urged me to cut back and stop using dip. Of course, I didn't argue with them. I didn't want to get kicked out of the SEALs or go down a road that might lead to a medical discharge. I suppose, in retrospect, some might wonder why I didn't do that, but it would have seemed like a cowardly thing to do. It would never have felt right. In the end, I was all right with being scheduled for another deployment. I still loved war. Delta Platoon. Usually, when you come home, a few guys will rotate out of the platoon. Officers will usually change out. A lot of times, the chief leaves. The LPO, lead petty officer, becomes the chief, and then someone else becomes LPO. But other than that, you stay pretty tight-knit. In our case, most of the platoon had been together for many years. Until now. Trying to spread out the experience and the team, command decided to break up Charlie Cadillac platoon and spread us out. I was assigned to Delta and put in as LPO of the platoon. I worked directly with the new chief, who happened to be one of my buds instructors. We worked out our personal selections, making assignments and sending different people off to school. Now that I was LPO, I not only had more admin crap to deal with, but couldn't be point man anymore. That hurt. I drew the line when they talked about taking my sniper rifle away. I was still a sniper, no matter what else I did in the platoon. Besides finding good point men, one of the toughest personnel decisions I had to make involved choosing a breacher. The breacher is the person who, among other things, is in charge of the explosives, who sets them and blows them, if necessary, on the DA. Once the platoon is inside, the breacher is really running things, so the group is entirely in his hands. There are a number of other important tasks and schools I haven't mentioned along the way, but which do deserve attention. Among them is the JTAC. That's the guy who gets to call in air support. It's a popular position in the teams. First of all, the job is kind of fun. You get to watch things blow up. And secondly, you're often called away for special missions, so you get a lot of action. Comms and navigation are a lot further down the list for most SEALs, but they're necessary jobs. The worst school you can send someone to has to do with intel. People hate that. They join the SEALs to kick down doors, not gather intelligence. But everyone has a role. Of course, some people like to fall out of planes and swim with the sharks. Sickos. The dispersal of talent may have helped the team in general, but as platoon LPO, I was concerned about getting the best guys over to Delta with me. The Master Chief in charge of personnel arrangements was working everything out on an organizational chart that had been set up on a big magnetic board. One afternoon while he was out, I snuck into his office and rearranged things. Suddenly, everyone who was anyone in Charlie was now assigned to Delta. My changes had been a little too drastic, and as soon as the Master Chief got back, my ear started ringing even more than normal. "Don't ever go into my office when I'm not here," he told me as soon as I reported to him. "Don't touch my board, ever." Well, truth is, I did go back. I knew he'd catch anything drastic, so I made one little switch and got Dauber into my platoon. I needed a good sniper and corpsman. The Master Chief apparently never noticed it, or at least didn't change it. I had my answer ready in case I was caught. I did it for the good of the Navy. Or at least Delta Platoon. Still recovering from knee surgery, I couldn't actually take part in a lot of the training for the first few months the platoon was together. But I kept tabs on my guys, watching them when I could. I hobbled around the land warfare sessions, observing the new guys especially. I wanted to know who I was going to war with. I was just about back into shape when I got into a pair of fights. First the one in Tennessee I mentioned earlier, where I was arrested, and then another near Fort Campbell where, as my son puts it, some guy decided to break his face on my daddy's hand. Some guy also broke my hand in the process. My platoon chief was livid. "You've been out with knee surgery, we get you back, you get arrested, now you break your hand. What the fuck?" There may have been a few other choice words thrown in there as well. They may also have continued for quite a while. Thinking back, I did seem to get into a number of fights during this training period. In my mind, at least, they weren't my fault. In that last case, I was on my way out when the idiot's girlfriend tried picking a fight with my friend, a SEAL, which was absolutely as ridiculous in real life as it must sound described here. But taken together, it was a bad pattern. It might even have been a disturbing trend. Unfortunately, I didn't recognize it at the time. Punched out. There's a postscript to the story about some guy and my broken hand. The incident happened while we were training in an army town. I knew pretty much when I punched him that I'd broken my hand, but there was no way in hell that I was going to the base hospital. If I did, they'd realize I was A, drunk, and B, fighting, and the MPs would be on my ass. Nothing makes an MP's day like busting a seal. So I waited until the next day. Now sober, I reported to the hospital and claimed I had broken my fist by punching out my gun before I actually cleared the door jam. Theoretically possible, if unlikely. While I was getting treated, I saw a kid in the hospital with his jaw wired shut. Next thing I knew, some MPs came over and started questioning me. "This kid is claiming you broke his jaw," said one of them. "What the hell is he talking about?" I said, rolling my eyes. "I just came in off a training exercise. I broke my damn hand. Ask the SF guys. We were training with them." Not so coincidentally, all of the bouncers at the bar where we'd been were Army SF. They would surely back me up if it came to that. It didn't. "We thought so," said the MPs, shaking their heads. They went back over to the idiot soldier and started bitching him out for lying and wasting their time. Serves him right for getting into a fight started by his girlfriend. I came back west with a shattered bone. The guys all made fun of me for my weak genes, but the injury wasn't all that funny for me, because the doctors couldn't figure out whether they should operate or not. My finger set a little deeper in my hand, not quite where it should be. In San Diego, one of the doctors took a look and decided they might be able to fix it by pulling it and resetting it in the socket. I told him to give it a go. "You want some painkiller?" he asked. "Nah," I said. They'd done the same thing at the Army hospital back east, and it hadn't really hurt. Maybe Navy doctors pull harder. The next thing I knew, I was lying flat back on a table in the cast room. I'd passed out and pissed myself from the pain. But at least I got away without surgery. And for the record, I've since changed my fighting style to accommodate my weaker hand. Ready to go. I had to wear a cast for a few weeks, but more and more I got into the swing of things. The pace built up and we got ready to ship out. There was only one down note. We had been assigned to a western province in Iraq. From what we had heard, nothing was going on there. We tried to get transferred to Afghanistan, but we couldn't get released by the area commander. That didn't sit too well with us, certainly not with me. If I was going back to war, I wanted to be in the action, not twiddling my broken fingers in the desert. Being a SEAL, you don't want to sit around with your thumb up your ass. You want to get in the action. Still, it felt good to be getting back to war. I'd been burned out when I came home, completely overwhelmed and emotionally drained. But now I felt recharged and ready to go. I was ready to kill some more bad guys. 13. Mortality. Blind. It seemed like every dog in Sodder City was barking. I scanned the darkness through my night vision, tense as we made our way down one of the nastiest streets in Sodder City. We walked past a row of what might have been condos in a normal city. Here they were little better than rat-infested slums. It was past midnight in early April 2008, and against all common sense but under direct orders, we were walking into the center of an insurgent hellhole. Like a lot of other drab brown buildings on the street, the house we were heading to had a metal grate in front of the door. We lined up to breach it. Just then, someone appeared from behind the grate at the door and said something in Arabic. Our interpreter stepped up and told him to open up. The man inside said he didn't have a key. One of the other SEALs told him to go get it. The man disappeared, running up the stairs somewhere. Shit! "Go!" I yelled. "Break the grate the fuck in!" We rushed in and started clearing the house. The two bottom levels were empty. I raced up the stairs to the third floor and moved to the doorway of a room facing the street, leaning my back against the wall as the rest of my guys stacked to follow. As I started to take a step, the whole room blew up. By some miracle, I hadn't been hit, though I sure felt the force of the blast. "Who the fuck just threw a frag?" I yelled. Nobody, and the room itself was empty. Someone had just fired an RPG into the house. Gunfire followed. We regrouped. The Iraqi who'd been inside had clearly escaped to alert the nearby insurgents where we were. Worse, the walls in the house proved pretty flimsy, unable to stand up to the rocket grenades that were being fired at us. If we stayed here, we were going to get fried. "Out of the house, now!" The last of my guys had just cleared out of the building when the street shook with a huge force. The insurgents had set off an IED down the street. The blast was so powerful it knocked a few of us off our feet. Ears ringing, we ran to another building nearby. But as we were fixing to enter it, all hell broke loose. We got gunfire from every direction, including above. A shot flew into my helmet. The night went black. I was blind. It was my first night in Solder City, and it looked like it was going to be my last on Earth. Out West. Until that point, I had spent an uneventful, even boring fourth deployment in Iraq. Delta Platoon had arrived roughly a month before, traveling out to Al-Qaim in western Iraq near the Syrian border. Our mission was supposed to involve long-range desert patrols, but we'd spent our time building a base camp with the help of a few CBs. Not only was there no action to speak of, but the Marines who owned the base were in the process of shutting it down, meaning that we'd have to move out soon after we set it up. I have no idea what the logic was. Morale hit rock bottom when my chief risked his life early one morning. By that I mean he entered my room and shook me awake. "What the hell?" I yelled, jumping up. "Easy," said my chief. "You need to get dressed and come with me." "I just got to sleep." "You'll want to come with me. They're putting together a task unit over in Baghdad." A task unit? All right. It was like something out of the movie Groundhog Day, but in a good way. The last time this happened to me, I was in Baghdad, heading west. Now I was west and heading east. Why exactly? I wasn't sure. According to the chief, I had been chosen for the unit partly because I was qualified to be an LPO, but mostly because I was a sniper. They were pulling snipers from all over the country for the operation, though he had no details of what was being planned. He didn't even know whether I was going to a rural or urban environment. Shit, I thought. We're going to Iran. It was an open secret that the Iranians were arming and training insurgents, and in some cases even attacking Western troops themselves. There were rumors that a force was being formed to stop the infiltrators on the border. I was convoyed over to Al-Asad, the big airbase in Al-Anbar province, where our top headshed was located. There I found out we weren't going to the border, but a place much worse, Solder City. Located on the outskirts of Baghdad, Solder City had become even more of a snake pit since the last time I'd been with the Groms a few years before. 2 million Shiites lived there. The rabidly anti-American cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, the city had been named for his father, had been steadily building his militia, the Mahdi Army, known in Arabic as the Jaish al-Mahdi. There were other insurgents operating in the area, but the Mahdi Army was by far the biggest and most powerful. With covert help from Iran, the insurgents had gathered arms and started launching mortars and rockets into Baghdad's green zone. The entire place was a viper's nest. Like Fallujah and Ramadi, there were different cliques and varying levels of expertise among the insurgents. The people here were mostly Shiites, whereas my earlier battles in Iraq had been primarily with Sunnis. But otherwise, it was a very familiar hellhole. This was all fine with me. They pulled snipers and JTACs, along with some officers and chiefs from Teams 3 and 8 to create a special task unit. There were about 30 of us all together. In a way, it was an all-star team with some of the best of the guys in the country. And it was very sniper-heavy, because the idea was to implement some of the tactics we'd used in Fallujah, Ramadi, and elsewhere. There was a lot of talent, but because we were drawn from all different units, we needed to spend a bit of time getting used to each other. Small differences in the way East Coast and West Coast teams typically operated could make for a big problem in a firefight. We also had a lot of personnel decisions to make, selecting point men and the like. The Army had decided to create a buffer zone to push the insurgents far enough away that their rockets would reach the green zone. One of the keys to this was erecting a wall in Sadr City, basically a huge cement fence called a T-wall that would run down a major thoroughfare about a quarter of the way into the slum. Our job was to protect the guys building that wall and take down as many bad guys as possible in the process. The boys building that wall had an insanely dangerous job. A crane would take one of the concrete sections off the back of a flatbed and haul it into place. As it was set down, a private would have to climb up and unhook it. Under fire, generally, and not just pop shots, the insurgents would use any weapon they had, from AKs to RPGs. Those Army guys had serious balls. A Special Forces unit had already been operating in Sadr City, and they gave us some pointers and intel. We took about a week getting things all worked out and figuring out how we were going to skin this cat. Once everything was settled, we were dropped off in an Army FOB, forward operating base. At this point, we were told we were going to foot patrol into Sadr City at night. A few of us argued that it didn't make much sense. The place was crawling with people who wanted to kill us, and on foot, we'd be easy targets. But someone thought it would be smart if we walked in during the middle of the night. Sneak in, they told us, and there won't be trouble. So, we did. Shot in the back. They were wrong. There I was, shot in the head and blind. Blood streamed down my face. I reached up to my scalp. I was surprised. Not only was my head still there, but it was intact. But I knew I'd been shot. Somehow I realized that my helmet, which hadn't been strapped, had been pushed back. I pulled it forward. Suddenly I could see again. A bullet had struck the helmet, but with incredible luck had ricocheted off my night vision, slamming the helmet backward but otherwise not harming me. When I pulled it forward, I brought the scope back down in front of my eyes and could see again. I hadn't been rendered blind at all, but in the confusion I couldn't tell what was going on. A few seconds later, I got hit in the back with a heavy round. The bullet pushed me straight to the ground. Fortunately, the round hit one of the plates in my body armor. Still, it left me dazed. Meanwhile, we were surrounded. We called to each other and organized a retreat to a marketplace we'd passed on the way in. We started laying down fire and moving together. By this time, the blocks around us looked like the worst scenes in Black Hawk Down. It seemed like every insurgent, maybe every occupant, wanted a piece of the idiot Americans who'd foolishly blundered into Sadr City. We couldn't get into the building we retreated to. By now, we'd called for QRF, a quick response force, a fancy name for the cavalry. We needed backup and extraction. Help, in capital letters. A group of Army strikers came in. Strikers are heavily armed personnel carriers, and they were firing everything they had. There were plenty of targets. Upward of 100 insurgents lined the roofs on the surrounding streets trying to get us. When they saw the strikers, they changed their aim, trying to take out the Army's big personnel carriers. There, they were overmatched. It started looking like a video game. Guys were falling off the rooftops.